So we have been in Mark, and by this time we're about three chapters into Christ's ministry in full swing. It's at the peak of its influence, or at least getting close to that. And what we see is the entire region, not only of Galilee where he's been ministering, but of Judea and even of the foreign nations being thrown into turmoil as they hear about this figure that is shocking. And the works that he's doing and the message that he is teaching, speaking as if from God himself, and in that authority, calling people to faith in himself. He is the object of the message, the one that God has sent, the one necessary to have fellowship with the Father. And he's describing himself in terms of life. He is life. He offers real life. And our need is to receive that life that he has by being conformed to his own pattern, raising his own fruit, bearing for a coming harvest. Today, as we've already mentioned a couple of times, is Palm Sunday. Palm Sunday is 1 week before the resurrection of Christ. 5 days before his journey to the cross. And on this day, Christ announces himself as he enters Jerusalem for the last time, knowing full well this is the last time he will be in the flesh in Jerusalem, at least the unresurrected flesh. Announces himself in clearly messianic terms that indicate that this is the king that Israel has been waiting for. And the people en masse, not everyone, recognize what's going on. Recognize that the Lord has come to them. And they're going to have their own battle of faith ahead, but it's a striking moment in the history of Israel. Our passage in Mark today is not the reading of Jesus' entry into Jerusalem, but it's deeply related because it's entirely about the identity of Christ. Now, before we get in depth, it occurred to me this week that when we approach the stories that we've been going over and will continue to go over of Christ, we don't all process them the same way. For example, much of Mark's explanation of Jesus' significance revolves around stories of miraculous events, legitimate miracles that demonstrate the hand of God having come to us. And not all of us are used to that. If we're in the church, then we're probably quite accepting of that, although we are affected by our world. But we might be new to the faith, or we might be seeking, or we might be a visitor for whom miracles are a major issue, and it's hard to come to the meaning of the story because they stand in the way. And I thought I'd take just a few minutes to discuss why a reasonable person would look at this testimony and say, this in fact happened, and it changes the world. You and I live, as I've told you for months and years, in a specific culture with specific strengths and weaknesses. We are indoctrinated into a culture. It teaches us what to believe about the world, and it teaches in our culture a profound and often unnecessary skepticism to what's unfamiliar. And at the same time, a profound and often unhelpful credulity, that is, readiness to believe something just because we're used to it. One of those statements that I've mentioned before and will mention again today is what is a completely indefensible statement. I only believe what science teaches me. This is how I measure truth, is scientifically. It's the only measure for truth. That's called scientism. It is unique to our place in history and really our place in the world, and it is dwindling rapidly in our culture. In some ways, I'm very grateful for that. In some ways, I'm not. What's being replaced too often is witchcraft, neo-paganism. But it is an indefensible statement to say that your life rests only on what can be measured through scientific demonstration. I'll give you two examples of why. One of the things that are babbled through in the philosophy of science today is how we can establish any system of knowing when it's not clear that the human mind has developed to be capable of genuine reasoning. or processing genuine and absolute truth. And the reason this arises in conversations in the philosophy of science is because the story that lives in our culture about where we came from explains our biology as a process of developing for advantage, not for truth. Our minds have developed as human beings, this story tells us, so that we can survive, and that's the only thing it's geared to do. And what that means is that there's no defensible means to say the mind must be interpreting the world accurately for truth, only for advantage. Many of you have heard the name Richard Dawkins. He's been one of the four horsemen of the atheistic apocalypse for, I don't know, decades now, probably 60 years, an avowed atheist. It was quite striking a number of years ago to hear him finally come to an admission that he had to make, because he believes in absolute truth, a standard by which everybody should live, even though there's some wiggle room there. He believes there is an absolute truth. And in his own words, he utterly has given his life to the statement of Jesus that the truth will set him free. If he can find truth, he will be free. And he was challenged on this because of his presuppositions about biology as a geneticist. How can you say such a thing when you know the story we tell about how the human mind developed? And so he made the admission that he has a religious commitment to truth. In scientism, only what can be measured by science is absolutely true. Everything else, values, guesses, everything else is religious in nature. And he had to admit that he was religious in nature in this fundamental presupposition for his life, that the truth is real, we can grasp it, and it's good in every case. His approach to the world is inescapably religious, even though it's thoroughly scientific. A second example that I've spoken about before is the question of whether the world is even real. We don't think about it in our culture, but this has been a major question throughout human history on which humans have not agreed and which cannot be measured in a beaker or a test tube. Is the world out there that you're experiencing actually out there, or is it in here? Is it real? Is it meaningful? Hindu culture, for example, particularly a hardcore Hinduism or a historical one, modern Hinduism tends to be synthesized with modern presuppositions. But it came to the conclusion that the material world you're experiencing every day is in the way of real life. It is the problem. What's the purpose of studying it? It's what's deceiving us all the time. It's only an illusion. If you could only pierce through it, we'd finally come to truth. But Christianity fundamentally disagrees on religious grounds. We believe God has revealed to us that the world is real, that it is not only real, but it is good. And that it's not only good, but that if we study it, God reveals himself to us through it. It's one of the ways that he makes himself known. And because of that, what we now know today as the scientific method developed in Christian culture, because we had a religious presupposition towards the world. We believed something on religious grounds about that world. And modern scientism is based on that Christian view of the world. It can't test it. It's impossible. All you people who grew up in the 90s watching The Matrix and being like, maybe that's real. You can't say it's not from a merely scientific perspective. It's a religious decision, a religious conviction. And so everything, my point is, that is performed within the scientific community is performed as something set within a religious perspective. It can't exist without it. And so it's very easy for me, if that's true, if for me even to begin measuring truth quantifiably requires making decisions on faith about the nature of the world, then clearly truth is bigger than scientism. Scientism can't even exist without a bigger truth. And a number of things start to fall into place after that. Another way I'd put it is that I have no religious pre-commitment to deny a spiritual world before I begin. Richard Lewontin, who was one of the most important biologists of the 20th century, was a materialist, believing only the material world exists. There's no spiritual world. And a naturalist, there's only the natural world. And he explained very clearly and very transparently what that meant. He spoke for all materialists, and he really does when he says this, when he wrote, "Our willingness to accept scientific claims, even if they're against common sense, even if everything in me says that can't be true, it exists because we have a prior commitment. Before we've even begun gathering data, let alone analyzing and concluding, we have a first commitment. A commitment to materialism. We're committed to this religious perspective. And that commitment, moreover, is that materialism is absolute, something that can't be found from material study itself. For we cannot allow a divine foot in the door." Do you see the catch-22 here? The circular reasoning. There's nothing wrong with the scientific method. It would be silly to throw it out. It's able to do things that other things can't do. But it's a strange thing when we begin weighing whether or not God is real. Whether there could be a supernatural being and at the outset saying, but we won't allow any supernatural possibility. We have made a circular argument. We've assumed the conclusion before we've even started the experiment. And this is, in fact, something that we are trained in from youth in our culture. Not even recognizing that there are alternatives or that we've been inculcated into a narrow-mindedness and a reduction of the size of the world. And the fact is, if the only way you're going to see the world is through the ocular lens of a microscope, you're choosing to see only a small part of a very big world. There's no way around it. Scientism is a deliberate and religious choice to see only a part of the world. Today, real historians, and there are many of them, use scientific methods to weigh the quality of what can be known about the past. They measure, they date, they analyze. And the conclusions, for example, that classical historians come to about the scriptures that we study here today are almost unchallenged in the historical community. Those conclusions are these: that the writings that you and I hold in our hands today are substantially the same as the one in Jesus' own generation. The rapidity with which they were copied and spread across the world is unlike anything else in all of history. There's not a single thing like it from the ancient world. It's magnitudes more. Hundreds of times more documents than the nearest one. And historians conclude, well, then what we're reading here today, it must have come from the first century, from those who were in living memory of Jesus himself. They also conclude that that living community must have actually believed what they wrote. It's not just that this was written shortly after the time of Jesus, within a lifespan. It's also they had to believe, and why? Because when you have a community with living memory of the events, if you start making up the stories, they start addressing you. Hey, that's not what happened. This isn't true. You know, something fascinating in all the dialogue between the church and non-believing Jews throughout history is that there's virtually nothing that the Jews ever denied about the life of Jesus. They accept that he was a miracle worker. They just explain it by the demonic. They accept that he died on a cross. They explained it as for his own sin. They accept that his body went missing. They explain it as because there was a big hoax or some other reason. The people who wrote this actually believed it. And that's very telling because modern historians come to another conclusion. This is where scientific evaluation leads them. That community that produced these works, most of those involved went to their deaths insisting it was true. Now, if you had people just copying copies of a story 300, 500, 1,000 years later, you could say, well, they didn't know any better. They died for what they believed in, but they couldn't know it was true. But what we actually have is strong evidence of eyewitness accounts who then went to the grave having seen the things they saw, saying, I cannot deny them, they're true. And so the use of scientific standards creates a rather unsettling probability. And that probability is that these events, in fact, occurred. You can say that they didn't on some basis that is religious in nature, a pre-commitment that that's not possible. But that's because of your own religious perspective and what you're willing to allow as a possibility. But we can know very little about history at all if we don't accept that these are eyewitness testimonies that went to their deaths to insist to you that this is how God has appeared in our world. And so a reasonable person absolutely can understand that truth is bigger than our modern biases, our prejudice, as almost anyone throughout the history of the world would agree, whether they're a Christian or not, that the world is bigger than what we're willing to use to determine truth. And this is just a scientific approach, if that's what you're hung up on, let alone all the personal experience and conviction that speaks on a far greater and broader level. Most of the most important things in this life are not reasoned. They're witnesses within ourselves that were planted there by God. That there is such a thing as beauty in the world, and it matters. That there is meaning. That there's trust. That love is something real and not just a great hoax. Something to live for. None of that can be measured scientifically, and most of us base our lives entirely around those truths that come to us from another witness. And my conclusion is that the world we live in is irreducibly spiritual. You cannot escape it. You can plug your ears, you can close your eyes, you can chant mantras to yourself over and over again that it's not so, but it is so. We live in a spiritual world where truth is much bigger than what can be quantified. So if that's something that you struggle with in the Christian faith and as we've worked our way through Mark, perhaps what you're needing to do is simply to lay down what is too small a standard to interact with this enormous world in which we find ourselves. To produce a better standard for truth than the one that you've been given. All right, open our scriptures and we'll start at verse 35 here again. We're going to work our way virtually word for word through Mark's testimony about the identity of Christ revealed through this storm. Verse 35. That day, when evening came, Jesus said to his disciples, "Let us go over to the other side." So one of the first things that Mark is impressing on us is the timing of these events. He's explicit. All of these things we've been talking about for weeks happened, and that same day, another event occurred. And why is that important that it happened the same day? because Mark wants to impress in us the pace at which Jesus is performing his ministry. He even mentions that evening. It's now nighttime we're moving into. Jesus has worked all day for the salvation of his people. He gets to nighttime and he's ready to travel because he has another place to go to reach more children of Israel. This is what he has come for. He will work himself to the bone to visit as many of the villages as God will lead him to. And so there's also some relation to what occurs in the events ahead of us. We expect him to be weary. We see also that it's night, which helps us to have some sympathy for what the disciples are about to experience it somewhat ourselves. It explains even more intensely the disorientation that they're about to go through. It's not just happening as a storm, but as a storm in the darkness. We can understand the panic and how much more pressing it is, but also that pressing reality of death coming for them that they are about to face. And how Christ's light will pierce not only the natural order, but even the storm that it produces in their own souls. Jesus says to them, "Let's go over to the other side." Again, the purpose here is that Jesus is traveling far and wide to reach those who haven't had an opportunity yet for his ministry. But there's something else that Mark is planting in our mind. And that is that Jesus is initiating what's about to come. He is the one leading them into the testing that's about to happen. He knows what's coming. He initiates. And he's ready to walk with them through it. He will be present with them through it all. This is the very same pattern, by the way, that we see following Jesus' own baptism, when the Holy Spirit leads him out to testing. And we lose something in the English language, at least modernly, maybe it hasn't always been so, when we say testing, because we think of finding out what's there. That's not what's happening. Scriptural testing isn't just finding out what's there. It's bringing to the surface what is real. It's discovering what has been sitting beneath all along so we can address it. Mark goes on, verse 36. Leaving the crowd behind, they took him along just as he was in the boat. There were also other boats with them. The next statement is that they leave the crowds they had been ministering to behind. And many, I think, insightful commentators throughout time have noticed that there might be a hint of Jesus addressing the disciples' pride in what's to come. You see, these disciples are traveling with Jesus, and there's always this visible reminder whenever they're finished ministering in a place that those people stay, but we go. We're with Jesus, and we leave them behind. And we know for a fact that the disciples struggled with pride and ambition and selfishness because they did it amongst themselves. Let me sit at your right hand and me at your left hand. How much more to those that they're leaving behind? And it's a reminder, if you think that you're someone great in the faith or that you have some special calling and God is with you, that these were the apostles. And they're about to get in a boat where God reveals to them that they're nothing. They are going to viscerally experience their own powerlessness, their helplessness, their hopelessness, the terror that death reigns over them, the smallness of their faith. And it's all going to be framed by a mere wind. All it takes is a little wind to throw them into the grave, where they would on their own never rise again. Done. Mark says that these apostles took Jesus along. Again, this is one of the passages where Mark seems to be so specific about his language. He has so much to say in the details. It's not just that they go over, it's that Jesus is so weary, he throws himself in the boat, and now these disciples have to row him. They are taking him along to perform his ministry. And it's yet another example of the humility of putting on human flesh. That part of Jesus' humility was that he willingly submits himself to the weakness of our bodies and the need for others to achieve the task that God has given him. And Mark says something else that's very conspicuous. It doesn't have to be said for any other reason except that it must be pointing us to something. It says, they took him along just as he was. In other words, he didn't stop to rest. He hasn't fed himself. He hasn't prepared. He's just thrown himself in a boat and go. Highlighting once again his tireless efforts. And this is a point for Mark about the effort in which God pursues us. Pursuing Israel in that first century, but it's the same today. And of course, we love the story, the parable of Jesus that reminds us that Christ follows the one and leaves the 99. But the fact of the matter is, what we're seeing right before our eyes professed is that Christ is chasing all the scattered 99. He's going after all of the scattered children of Israel, not just one. And it's the same for you today. Christ's efforts are undeniably in your life to bring you to the kingdom that he would promise you. Look for them. So by the time we get here, it's no wonder that Jesus is sleeping. Mark has been establishing his exhaustion. And what's incredible is that this King of Heaven, in his exhaustion, reserves for himself only a cushion beneath a boat seat for him to rest on his way. Verse 37. A furious squall came up, and waves broke over the boat so that it was nearly swamped. Jesus was in the stern, sleeping on a cushion. The disciples woke him and said to him, "Teacher, don't you care if we drown?" The squall finally comes, the storm that could end it all. And we've said it's no surprise to Jesus, but it is very much a surprise to his disciples, as are many of life's events that befall those who follow him today. They are now facing death face to face. I don't know if you've ever seriously faced the probability that that was your last time on earth. I remember going spelunking down in caves, and I got 700 feet down and my flashlight broke and the group had left me. So I used my Timex. This is an advertisement. They pay me. And I just made my way off these ledges all the way up. It still didn't occur to me that that would be my last. I thought, I'm going to make it out of this. I've got Timex. That's not what these people experience. And maybe you've experienced it for a moment. I've had something closer to that. I've certainly had many around me who for a moment realized that was so close. This is a prolonged event for them. They are throwing water out of the boat with all their might as it comes in faster. They see the writing on the wall. They know it's coming. They have time to process. They are thrown into an existential crisis. This is irresistible. I'm not making it out of this. I'm dead. And something like that experience in your life is unlike any other. You will never see the world again the same way. Because you've been stripped of everything, all the distractions, all the delusions, all the I'll think about it later, and it's here, and it's now, and this is it, and I'm about to find out what's true. And all the faith that they've been building in their lives and thinking and all the glorious ideas about God that they've been pondering on their pillows. They're either going to turn out to be true or nothing. And they know they're facing this moment and it's inescapable. And this is what elicits the tempest in their own souls, the really meaningful storm that goes on in them. And Jesus, Mark tells us, is sleeping. And this, too, is not by chance. This, too, is the master's decision not to be there, present in the leadership role as they face this storm. He's determined it's best if he's crawled under the seat out of the way so they can feel what it's like to face death on their own. So they'll feel completely exposed without a mediator. So they will viscerally experience the power, irresistible power of what's coming for them. An emphasis by omission, in which absence makes the heart grow desperate. And they do feel the need for him. Their minds reel, looking for some solution because they don't have the power and it lands on him. And in a flash, I'm certain, all kinds of thoughts go through their mind, defying time as we're used to it, about who he really is and what he might actually be capable of doing and what he's going to do now. And so they wake him. And I think we should conclude that they did the most important thing, which was go to him. They put an end to trusting their own strength, which proved futile, and they said, we have to go to the master. We need someone else. But the emphasis of Mark is how unstable they still are in their thoughts. They're still being driven by this mortal desperation. Their vision is narrowed to raw survival. How do I get out of this alive? They don't have the capacity to sit back and say, God is with me. What's God doing in my life in the world? I wonder how many of us could. And they make a demand of Christ. At least they imply one. And it's intensely personal. What's the question they ask him? Not, are you going to save us or can you do something about this? Don't you care? Do you care nothing for us? Is there nothing between us? Do we matter to you or not? You see, in their helplessness, they realize that everything hinges on nothing that's in their power, not a single thing. Everything hinges on the attitude of another person who can do something about it. And there's even an accusation behind their question. They're not just saying, don't you care? They're saying, what's wrong with you that you don't care right now? What is wrong with you, Christ? You're doing nothing because you don't care. And whether they know it or not, they're attempting to leverage something to their wills in him. Speaking to him this way, what's wrong with you? Don't you realize you should care? And as they speak again, it's another layer of their own powerlessness that's revealed to them. Either he does or he doesn't. I can't force him. And this one that they've wondered and associated with the possibility that he really is God himself, I can't shame God. I can't judge God. I can't convince God. I can't force God. I can't hold God accountable, even if he's wrong. Either God is going to love me freely, or I'm dead. These are the only two possibilities that lie before my future. They're going to define everything from here on out. And now they're truly panic-stricken, fully exposed to death with only a prayer as their hope. They are beginning to see the human situation for what it really is for all of us. And they just don't know. They do not know what happens next. They don't know if God cares. They don't know if this master will prove true to his word. We move on. Verse 39. Jesus got up, rebuked the wind, and said to the waves, "Quiet, be still." Then the wind died down, and it was completely calm. He said to his disciples, "Why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith?" And they were terrified and asked each other, "Who is this? Even the wind and the waves obey him." Well, Christ proves himself and reveals his intent towards these disciples who are so hopeless. First of all, he shows that he does in fact have the power to save, that he is the master of all creation. You know, it's easier by magnitudes to believe that someday some man or woman could arise who would conquer every human will by force and force every human being to do their will than it is to believe that nature would listen to even a single request. It would be easier to subdue the whole race of man than to do what Jesus does. And the implications that Mark is impressing on us are overpowering. This person who was sleeping under the seat of the boat is God. He's above the natural world. He commands it. But Jesus is not done rebuking. He next turns and Mark says, he said to his disciples, the ones who doubted that God cares. And he casts this question into them as well. Why did you doubt? This whole event we're about to see occurs not because God doesn't care, but precisely that because he does. And not only that he does, but to show he does, which could only be demonstrated in testing. Christ wants to prove it unmissably. He cares. He wants it to be ingrained in a way in their consciences that they'll never forget it again. I wonder if they ever smelled the Sea of Galilee without thinking of this event again, or felt a wind blow up suddenly and not think about what happened on those waters, or faced uncertainty in their lives, or even ended up on their own cross, literally, knowing they wouldn't be taken down, without thinking of what God revealed about himself that night. It's quite apparent by the time we get past Pentecost that they never saw death the same way again as they did that day. And Christ's question is, why are you afraid? As if fear in our lives is not only unnecessary, but it's also unwarranted. It's inappropriate. It's not consistent with what we've experienced about the world. There's this background that Christ is asking about. Hasn't God proven himself to you before? Hasn't he proven himself to you yet? Isn't the hidden character of God revealed visibly in the world through the stories of Noah that were the foundation of these men that learned it from their childhoods, of Abraham, your forefather, of his sons, of the tribes which came from them, of myself in these past months as I've walked with you and provided for you? Now, it's true. You and I can never see the mind of God just like we can't see the mind of another human being. But we judge God like we learn to judge humans, by what we can see, by what is shown to us. And we start to reconstruct an understanding of what lies beneath what we've seen, who that real person is, what their personality and character is like. And the history of Israel proved over and over again that God cherishes not only his nation of Israel, but all the nations of the earth, every human being created in his image, and that God fulfills his promises to those people, and that God provides even when they're in rebellion to him, causing the sun to rise on the wicked and the righteous. As the author of Hebrews will reflect, and I often draw your attention to this in Hebrews 11, it's precisely like the example of Sarah, who, being well beyond childbearing days, received a promise from God that she would still produce a child from her flesh. And how did she process that? Precisely the way Christ expected of us and his disciples. She considered the one who made the promise worthy. She couldn't see the promise. She couldn't see how it would happen. She didn't have the answers. She had a couple of bare facts. This person made a promise to me, and this person has always provided his promises before. And that's what's running behind Jesus' question of the apostles. That's the faith that he says, "Do you have none of it? Don't you know by now who God is? Don't you really cling to that as if it's the first and greatest truth of the whole world?" Christ's rebuke calms these souls. Yes, God does care. Yes, God does intend to intervene for the powerless. And the result in the apostles that carries forward in future days, especially after Pentecost, as I've said, is that death's power is stripped from their lives. Hebrews describes our former state as the devil ruling through death, the fear of death, enslaving us by the fear of death. That power is now gone from the disciples' lives. They've stood in death. They've known it was coming. They've known their own powerlessness, their inability to resist it. They've known that they'll fall to it. And someone intervened. Intervened out of a power they didn't have, and out of a love they could not force. And so Mark ends with a reflection on the word in Greek could either be terrified or marvel. It's just this overwhelming shock. And like always, this story about Jesus ends with the primary subject. Who is this person? He is the focus of every one of these stories, and that is the question about him in every one of these stories. And so they have this new terror that they have seen God. It's the only conclusion they can come to. He's the only one with power over this creation. And I'm sure in a moment the conviction falls upon them about their own ingratitude that they've demonstrated, even with this indictment in their question, "What's wrong with you? You don't care," of how faithless they have been in the middle of this. What they've done is they've sought to employ God to serve their lives, which is what we do even in the church. Every day this is our struggle. I'm going to get God to serve my purposes. And they realize what they should have been doing was employing their lives to serve the one that was sleeping in their midst. And what's really interesting is that this is not the last storm that they'll be saved from. And in this first one, they wonder. And they're coming to the conclusion, and they're already further associating this Christ with God himself. But perhaps you know how the next time will end that Christ saves them from the storm. This one ends in wonder. The next one ends in worship as they fall beneath him, before him, and worship him as king. Well, let's close with a few reflections. Why are these disciples so easily unsettled? It's a question that applies to us. It's a question that's important for us as we walk away from this. Didn't they know that he was powerful? Powerful to save? And didn't they know that he was faithful? Don't we know the same things about God, and yet we retread the same waters, pun intended, fearing and anxious and doubting and the same accusations? What is wrong with you? This is hard. This is dangerous. This is uncertain. What is wrong with you? We're still weighing it today. And the incredible thing, and maybe we should take some encouragement from this story, is that the result of their experience not only benefits them, it benefits us. We're still reading it today on Palm Sunday when we should be reading about the entry into Jerusalem. We're still shaken by storms. And the battle that we are engaged in is still the same. He cares. Does he care? Why do we put ourselves through fear and worry? These things begin irresistibly outside our hearts, but why do we welcome them in? Why do we let them consume our minds just because they're presented there for a moment? If we have real faith, that faith is not established in the outcome, it's established in the character, the person of God. Do I trust a person? And then, of course, we still have the ultimate trial that they faced, which is death. We're still going to stand before the same storm. And in our own power, we will fall. And in terms of mortality, it's very probable every one of us will literally fall to the power of death without a single means to resist it. We can't just put off the thought. You know, I do quite a few funerals, and I know that a lot of people come and they don't want to listen because they don't want to think about this. That's a problem down the road. But you never know how far down the road it really is. And it's still not the way to plan for the future, is I'll deal with it when I come to it. We'll stand before this same storm. And the thing is that as we've talked here about a witness to truth that's available to humanity beyond merely what's measurable, what's scientific, one of the greatest and most human witnesses that all of us have is that death is not natural. It's not right. It's not meant for us. It is a tyrant. It is evil. It is wicked. It should be resisted. It should be hated. Because it's not why God created the human race. There is nothing human about us if we come to the conclusion that death is something we were meant for. It's something we have trapped ourselves in. And Christ answers the apostles' accusation by demonstrating he has both power and desire to save. Maybe one last thought that I would have in your mind. Jesus' answer to the apostles' accusation, doesn't God care? The answer that results throughout Mark, all throughout Mark, here and following and before, is actually what separates the Christian faith from every other faith. As an example, Muslims and Jews can accept the reality of an almighty God. What they cannot accept is the Christ that is described in a story like this. Because their hearts can't be brought, at least yet, to accept what Christ stands for. It is much less offensive for a man to claim to be God. What is so offensive and a stumbling block is that God could have lowered himself to man. That he could have been exhausted and slept under a chair. That he could have joined creation as a creature, one of us. And not only that, but Christ goes further, as if that's not enough to swallow, as the lowliest creature, the one who washes feet, the one who accepts without rebuke the curses of his enemies, the one who submits as if he were helpless when he's not, submits himself to the violent hands of his enemies, who invites the whip, who takes the cross, who tastes death, the one who joins the lot of the unrighteous, the ones we're inclined to spit upon. It's that extreme that is so offensive, and it's that extreme claim of the extent of God's care for us that is so striking, not only in this story, but in the incarnation as a whole. God cares so much, he made himself least. That is the personality and character of God, to receive abject humiliation out of his love for his creation. There's no reason in light of that that we have to fear or to doubt or to worry. We will go on struggling, but we don't have to fall. Even when the heart doesn't understand every storm we face, we know we have a God who does not abandon, who is unwavering in his faithfulness, and who never fails. And that man whom the disciples discovered on that day with clarity is still the same man for you today. I'll invite our worship team back up as we conclude. I encourage you to remember the Lord this week as we prepare for that Friday event. Christ is in Jerusalem today. He remains one more week with us to reveal one last time the extent of God's faithful love for you. He is headed to his cross, and nothing will deter him for your sake. He is faithful to the end, attentive to your need. He is a savior to the doomed and the burdened. And he is God, as he has always been. Lord Jesus Christ, we praise you. And we pray that today, as you enter Jerusalem, you would enter our midst and turn our minds to you and save us. We confess you, fully human, fully God, the sole master and mediator of our humble race. We put our faith in you, for you have shown yourself good. In Christ's name, amen.